It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
Well, let's just do that. We have the gentleman in studio right now. Good morning, Cecil. Good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Mike.
We had a great conversation last week talking about elder law and asset protection. I know that stimulated probably a lot of thought with our listeners out there. Anything else you want to add to that conversation?
Yes, let's continue that today, Mike, and kind of, if you will, kind of talk about some tidbits, some bits and pieces out there that maybe Wes and I deal with on a pretty regular basis. This topic begins to frame up as asset protection, Mike, like we talked about last week, where, you know, our clients, for whatever reason, are concerned about the cost of long-term care in a nursing facility. I mean, that now is a good, you know, $6,000-$7,000 and counting a month. And some folks have Social Security, of course, you know, they might have even a nice Social Security, $1,800, let's say, a month, but $1,800 is not $7,000. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the difference between the two is going to have to be paid out of pocket by the client. They, of course, are going to need to deplete their savings, if you will, their IRA, whatever they happen to have in liquidity. Potentially, their home is up for lien recovery if it were when the second spouse dies. And so there are a lot of issues out there to talk about. And what I think Wes and I suggest more than anything else is just that. Let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's sit down for an hour. Let's get the facts and circumstances, and let's begin to structure a long-term plan for you and your family. One of the tidbits, for instance, is that Wes and I many times hear the child comes in the appointment too,
sure.
Let's say.
Sure.
The adult daughter, maybe the adult son. And, well, you know, Mom, I take care of Mom right now. She lives next door. Or I go by, you know, X number of hours a day, and then my adult child, the grandchild who's in their 20s, they spend the night there. These, you know, the families come together during
mm-hmm.
these times.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful thing to see. Well, that's great that the daughter is taking care of the mom, that the grandchild is taking care of the mom, and that many times the next thing we hear, Mom is paying us. Now, she's not able to pay a whole lot, but she's paying $20 an hour or $15 an hour, okay? Well, that needs to be reduced to what we call a personal services contract or caregiver contract, because otherwise these transfers of money from Mom to her daughter for personal care or to her granddaughter for personal care, even a friend out of the church or the community, a transfer of money to these folks, it adds up.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing you know, we're talking about, you know, $4,000-$6,000 over the course of 6 months, a year, whatever the case might be. And of course, when there happens to be application for any kind of benefit, if this loved one eventually goes into a facility, then those transfers are going to be looked at as gifts. So one of the things that Wes and I would be we're armed with information, you know, as a lawyer, and to recognize issues, is that here is a very, very wonderful, nice, factual circumstance going on out there in the real world. Mom or elderly dad are paying son or daughter, grandson, granddaughter to help them. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they never in a million years would think, well, we need to reduce that to writing. Now, with that said, Wes has had just a fascinating case out of one of our neighboring counties where we had to take the case all the way up to the higher courts because of the fact that the local, Department of Social Services denied the applicant any kind of benefit to pay for her nursing home because she had been paying over the course of 3 or 4 years at arm's length friends in the community to take care of her. Her payments to caregivers, if you will, were not even the children or the grandchildren. They were friends and neighbors in her wonderful community in a neighboring county. Wes, talk to us a little bit about that case. You were very involved in that.
Right, no doubt. That was an unusual set of circumstances. But, you know, it kind of brings to light the fact that when you're dealing with a Medicaid application for adult nursing home care, adult Medicaid services, you're dealing with a county, okay? In one county, DSS, Department of Social Services, may do things differently than another county. We all have to read all off the same page of music with regard to the law, because the law is the same from one county to the next. But this grassroots starting place where you start with this application, sometimes when the county department sees something that's unusual, they interpret it in a way that kind of makes you scratch your head a little bit. And that's what happened in this case that I'm about to talk about. But basically, you know, the overriding law here is that if you're a family member and you're taking care of a loved one, which as Cecil just set forth, that is something that's, you know, kind of common. You know, it's kind of common that the kids or the grandkids are, you know, swinging into action and doing the family thing and taking care of the loved one, the grandma, mom, whomever it may be. But if you're being paid for doing that, which is certainly okay, then that is going to be deemed as a gift. And in the event that this person has to go into a skilled nursing facility, then any of those transfers, any of the gifts, any of the payment that's been made during the last 5 years is going to all be added up by DSS. And they're going to say, okay, well, you paid your family over the past 5 years, you know, $30,000. It adds up. And so we have to sanction you for a period of months, which for $30,000 would be about 5 month period of time where Medicaid is not going to be approved. So you're going to have to come up with, you know, $6,000 or $7,000 per month to pay for this sanction period. Okay. But if you have the personal services contract, if you have a contract, a written contract with your family member who's taking care of you, then the law on that is simply that those payments, as long as they're reasonable compensation, are not a gift, but they're actually compensation for work being performed. So it's just the difference between planning ahead and not planning ahead. If you plan ahead and you have the contract, fine. Compensation is great. And that's really a good planning tool, too, because it allows us for the person to be taken care of in the home and for the assets to be at least get closer to that threshold with regard to being eligible for Medicaid in a legal way.
And this is all under that umbrella of protecting assets that we talked about. We started the conversation last week where we talked about perhaps putting the home widowed individual into a trust or an LLC. There's differences there, but
correct. And so, what you're beginning to see, Mike, is that we're going to recognize the issues that are ever present at that time with the family. I mean, for instance, it's not like usually on Monday we're doing great and on Thursday we're in a skilled care facility. I mean, this is something that evolves over usually a course of time. Okay. So we may have an elder person in our office with their son or daughter, and all we need to do at that point is to structure the home place in the trust. The family then goes on about their life. Then, of course, during that appointment, there's some conversation about a child, grandchild, helping grandmama. Well, we want to say, that's great. When it comes to that, recontact Harvell and Collins, and we will do a very simple reduce to writing the caregiver contract. So it's a process that we go through.
Seems pretty simple. I mean, this doesn't sound like this.
This
is not Chinese math.
It's fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
But the devil is in the details.
Yeah.
But also, you have to give your lawyer, by the way, an opportunity to guide you. I mean, this caregiver's contract is critical. And in our file in a neighboring state, I mean, we were up to what? Well over $100,000, wasn't it, Wes? Maybe
close to $200,000.
Wow.
So I was kind of laying the foundation for that.
But, yes.
Yeah.
And so that the listeners would understand. But also understand this dynamic. is if the family member is being paid and then the loved one has to go and make application for the long-term care services and then is caught that, okay, you've been paying your family members, that's kind of earmarked. Mm-hmm. And then you come to the attorney and say, what do we do about this? Well, the attorney is not going to say, we'll prepare a family services contract and date it, backdate it.
Yeah.
That's fraud. You can't do that. Okay, that's Medicaid fraud. So you have to have the document ahead of time.
How does someone get caught, if you will, by paying a family member, and then later it is disclosed that you, like in your case, several hundred thousand dollars? Do they have they go to bank records and see that, you know?
When you make application, you have to provide what they ask for, and that okay. is the advice that the attorneys are giving the clients, you know, that a good attorney should give the client, gather the information that the Department of Social Services is asking for. They're there to help you, but you got to help yourself. Okay. So they will ask for 5 years of bank statements.
Okay.
They will ask for that information, and the bank statements are just going to show what the transactions were.
Yeah. So, and they may show a check written to son or daughter in the name of son or daughter.
Cash, which is a problem.
Or that was what I was going to bring up, a check for, you know, $500 cash, but $500 cash every single week.
Where did that go?
Or $2,000 a month,
right.
You know, $24,000 a year, 24,000 times 3 years, we're talking about, you know, $70,000+. It's a lot of money. It's all happened within the last 3 years. There is a 5-year look back period. Okay. So yes, they're going to look at checks and bank accounts and bank statements, money markets, etc., for the last 5 years. And that's then when they would see these payments. Again, Wes and I are not saying this to our listeners to frighten anybody. I think that Wes is absolutely correct. Our DSS agents are just the best. They are there to help you. What they don't want is for you to misguide them, to not give them accurate information.
Yep.
They would rather you give them the accurate information and then help you with that. They will help you also in putting square pegs in square holes and round pegs in round holes, but they can't help you if you do not disclose to them accurate information. And we at our law firm are very, very upfront with these Department of Social Services workers. We like them a lot. We work with them very regularly. And we work with them in many different counties, I might add. We even worked very appropriately with the one that we had the disagreement with mm-hmm. about several hundred thousand dollars of caregiver monies that were to people in the community. The worker was fine. She didn't like, but she was getting guidance from some other folks that were higher up than her, and that was the way it went. We were able to be successful in that case. We were a bit confused by the interpretation in that case all along, because it was clear that the monies were being given to people to care for the older lady, and she eventually did go into a nursing facility.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting, and you said, you know, contact Harvell and Collins. You can do that. Call 726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. An important topic and something that is easily remedied, I believe, and the nice thing is it's transparent and it's all above board and it's recognized in the court of laws,
sure.
So it protects you. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with our friends from Harvell and Collins. And Wes, we started talking about a case that you were working on that was very, very fascinating as far as caregiver money. And we're talking six figures of money given to the caregiver.
That was a head scratcher for us. You know, that came out of a different county. And, you know, basically what happened with it was the Medicaid application was flagged, stopped, and it was denied. And of course, when there's a denial of a Medicaid application, which, you know, in our office, when we send an application over, we don't send applications over that should be denied because that's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
We know how the law works. We know what the situation is. The only reason one of our Medicaid applications would be denied is if something happened outside of our control,
right,
like paying someone who shouldn't have been paid, you know, and that ends up like a family member for services, something like that. So anyway, this one gets denied out of a different county. So, of course, we ask the basis of the denial, which we're entitled to do, and they provide the basis. And basically, long story short on that, is that the applicant, the mother, had been paying, as Cecil's indicated, various caregivers in the community for like a couple years. She was staying in the home. She needed caregivers. She had some money. So she was paying them a reasonable rate just to take care of her, to be in the home, maybe to do a little light cooking, you know, to be there with her so that she would be safe, you know, those type things. We all know the scenario, right?
Yeah.
And so these caregivers that were being provided compensation, they weren't family members. They were just caregivers. It's like hiring a care service, you know, any of these in-home care services we hear about.
Mm-hmm.
So be that as it may, the Department of Social Services in the respective county said that there had to be a personal services contract for compensation for care services. And, you know, we got on the phone with them and said, no, that's only for family members. It's very clear here in the law. Well, we're going to sanction it anyway. I'm like, okay. Well, please, you know, we're talking to them. You need to contact, you know, the AG's office, you know, contact the North Carolina Attorney General's office.
Sure.
Let's get an attorney on the line here. Let's analyze this together so we don't, you know, end up creating a real problem for this family based on a misinterpretation of law. So the office that we were dealing with just took a very hardline approach on it. We knew they were wrong in the analysis, but they just wouldn't budge. And they really wouldn't engage anyone else. All their various avenues of support, for example, AG's office, like I mentioned, the local Department of Social Services, they have attorneys on staff.
Sure. Yeah.
They didn't do any of that.
Yep.
And we begged them to do that, put it in writing, so on and so forth. They wouldn't do it. So then we have, what do? Well, we've got the client, the mother, who now is in a nursing home because her doctor is saying, this is where she needs to be. Okay, this is the level of care she needs. We have her two sons who are scraping up every penny they have to pay for her care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do? We have to appeal the decision. And as most appeals go, appeals don't work quickly. Okay. And when you appeal from a Medicaid application denial, it's a multiple level process. You have like three levels of appeal before you ever get to a court. So appeal level number one, our appeal was denied. Appeal level number two, denied. Appeal level number three, denied.
Ooh.
But kind of like a rubber stamp, not really. It's almost like you go into the appeal, and we've dealt with these before. It's like you go into the appeal, and the body hearing the appeal, the person hearing the appeal, defers to the expertise of the Department of DSS and thinks, well, since they denied it, they must be right, even though it was clearly wrong. So I told Andrew Foster, who's the attorney who's kind of handling the majority of it, I said, we're not going to get anywhere until we get to the Superior Court. So we appeal, we'll get to the Superior Court and have a hearing on it. And basically, when we finally get to the Superior Court level, the Attorney General's office is involved in it. They have to be involved in it because they're defending it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they immediately call us and say, I don't know what this Department of Social Services was doing. They're wrong. You're right. We'll agree with you. Well, that only took a year and a half.
Oof.
Wow. Right.
Yeah. So we even obtained, in an effort to convince the lower level that we were correct on behalf of our client, that we got affidavits from these caregivers, you know, where they affirmed under oath, look, I was there from, you know, 7 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. And, you know, I worked. I was a caregiver. This was not a gift. This was not a Christmas present. This was not for me. This was not, you know, for me to go buy my groceries. This was all because of the fact that I was taking care
providing service of
so-and-so. Now, that's unusual, but that happens. And, and again, that's kind of, Mike, like we were saying earlier, the devil is in the details. So what's important is for the client to come in, And lay out the facts that are currently existing. I'm not going to give specifics, but you kind of mentioned your mom a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's just very simple what we need. Maybe yeah. all we need is just to update the power of attorney. We've talked about that so much on the program, that it has specific language with regard to allowing the children to eventually do what's necessary to protect the assets. We might not be at a position right now where we need to protect the assets because grandmama's just 80 years old and doing great. She's still frying chicken every day, okay? There's a lot of 80-year-olds out there that are doing really well, okay? But they do own their home. They own it paid for. And so that 80-year-old might, all that they might need is just an updated power of attorney. And yes, go ahead and put the home in a protected, environment, a trust so that it is protected. Everything else stays the same.
And I think it's important to
status quo
for the person that didn't hear last week's show and is listening now, putting it in a trust. I don't want to lose control of my property. As you describe it, you don't. It's just you've now protected it. You're still living there and it's still yours.
You don't lose any control.
No.
You know, we only have, what, 3 or 4 minutes left, but that kind of brings up another point. And we kind of started today's program with a couple tidbits here and there, questions we get.
Yep.
You know, another thing that Cecil and I hear quite often is, well, I'm just going to deed my house to my son.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some pitfalls with that. Why would you not do that? Okay. Well, several reasons. Number one. If you just put it in your son's name or your daughter's name or both of their names in order to try to keep the property out of the purview of Medicaid, then obviously if you do that within 5 years of the time that you need the Medicaid, then that's going to be pulled right back in.
Look
it's
back.
Going to be sanctioned.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you start putting your property in your kids' names, then your property is going to ride the twists and turns of their life. If your child has to go through a bankruptcy because of the coronavirus, my goodness, who saw that coming four months ago?
Right, nobody.
A divorce, you know, any kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your child was in a car accident. They're sued. Then your property is
exposed.
As I say, sometimes on the chopping block is there.
Yeah.
If you structure it in a proper trust like we use, is undoubtedly non-countable and not subject to the estate recovery, but it also is not subject to those twists and turns and pitfalls of your children's lives where you can potentially expose your property to some liability and maybe lose it. So that trust is a tight little box.
Yeah.
That really gives you possession. It gives you the right to use the property as you always have. It protects it. And it keeps it from the twists and turns of other family members' situations.
It sounds simple, and it really is. It sounds simple. Call Harvell and Collins and find out for yourself. 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back with our final segment after this message. Pedigree here. I didn't know that, counselor. Very good. Well, with the few moments we have remaining here, I'll pass the ball over to Wes Collins here and maybe wrap up today's show at least. It's a lot to talk about. And it's something, person my age, I'm 58, and I have a mother-in-law 89 and my mother's 85. You're hitting home with what you're talking about here.
Well, this is real stuff for everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad is in his late 70s and, you know, this planning is something that's part of what he's done and we put him in this. My sister and me, and you know, unfortunately lost my mom years ago. My dad's doing well, but protecting the home, you know, he has this trust put in place.
I'm sure he does.
Thing. And you know, he doesn't need caregivers yet, and he's doing all those kind mm-hmm. of things. But nevertheless, you know, the percentages are that every family's going to deal with this at some point in time. It's just, I guess the kind of moral of the story here is don't just let it happen around you and then pick up the pieces when something happens. Go ahead and plan ahead, caregiver contract, protect the home, whatever it may be. Sit down with someone, you know, who knows what they're doing and get their advice.
It's good advice. You know, we prepare for hurricanes each year. We know they're coming, and we know the end of life is coming at some point, too. Yeah. Prepare for that as well.
See you next week, Mike.
Thank you, Cecil.
Okay.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. All right, boys. Harvell and Collins. Call them at 726-9050 or harvellandcollinsonline.com.